From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, could Illinois have a new state agency that focuses on early childhood? That's a proposal from the Pritzker administration. The governor's also pushing for changes to the health insurance industry. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Peter Hancock, a reporter for Capital News Illinois. Peter, always good to have you back with us.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, the governor proposing a new state agency, that doesn't happen every day. What is he talking about here, Peter?
Yeah, you're right. This doesn't happen every day. It is kind of a big deal, but it's basically consolidating programs and services for early childhood education and child care. They're currently scattered among like three different state agencies, and the governor would like to consolidate them into one new state agency. Early childhood development and education has always been kind of one of the big one of Governor Pritzker's big political motivations. That's kind of why he got into politics. And so he wants to consolidate it into a new Department of Early Childhood. It would administer, the block grants for preschools, the home visits for newborn children, especially those who are born with disabilities, and children of low-income families, and put all of this into one agency so that, if you're a family in Illinois and you're looking for services, especially if you have a child with special needs, you just go to one agency and it's all right there, sort of a one-stop shop, I think is kind of the popular term they like to use now. It's all right there in one place, and you don't have to navigate all these different agencies to get the things that you need.
So there's some ease of use. Charlie, you've seen state agencies, I guess, proposed, but also sometimes actually enacted, where the state has brought new ones on. Are there some other reasons to have a standalone existing agency? It seems to me like it just calls more attention to the issue you're trying to address here.
Well, I think in my mind it makes sense because, as Peter mentioned, these programs now exist, but they're in other agencies whose main mission is not to administer this program. For example, the preschool block grants are with the State Board of Education, and the State Board of Education has a much bigger responsibility in providing the support and the oversight of all the school districts in the state of Illinois, from K through 12 education, or the licensing of daycare centers is done by the Department of Children and Family Services. Their focus is on protecting kids who've been abused, not necessarily at licensing daycare. And so by gathering all these child care, early child care programs together in one place, in my mind, it makes more sense. And the legislation to do that is advancing through the General Assembly. As a matter of fact, the Senate bill that would do it is ready for a final vote in the Senate, and the House bill has come out of committee and it's at amendment stage in the House. And so there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of opposition. The vote in the House committee to move it along was 14-0. Last month. So there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of opposition. There's concern about, will this cost us more? And the person that Pritzker named to oversee this, Ann Whalen, testified before House Budget Committee that much of the money that the new agency will use will be federal dollars. And the cost of the administering the programs is the big concern. How much more is this going to cost us? The governor is asking $13.1 million in this coming budget to get this Department of Early Childhood off the ground. So we'll see where it goes. But as I say, I think it's a good idea to have an agency that focuses on these programs particular, where now as they're, I don't know if afterthought is too cruel a word, but they're not the primary focus of the Department of Education or Children and Family Services or Human Services.
Yeah, Peter, like Charlie said, especially something the governor's office is pushing, something like this doesn't move along without much opposition very often. And you know, you were covering this as it's moved through. So is that what's happening here? People on both sides are on board?
Well, there is a lot of concern about the cost, and the administration is not being real forthcoming with any estimates about what it will cost when this thing is fully up and running. It's going to take a couple of years. That $13 million for this year is to just start hiring executive staff and buying computers to start a new agency. It wouldn't actually start taking over the programs for another couple of fiscal years. And they have said this is not going to be revenue neutral. You know, at the end of the day, this may end up costing the state more than what we're paying now in administrative costs for having these programs scattered among different agencies. But I think the administration is saying that's not our primary concern. Our concern is improving the delivery of services to this part of the population. And you know, it's a policy priority for them. And if it ends up costing more, then so be it. But lawmakers are cognizant of the fact that the state is heading into what could be some, you know, lean budget times for the next few years. And they're kind of concerned about where every dollar is going. So those kinds of conversations will take place as they are working toward this. But I think in the end, you know, governors are given a great deal of deference to organize the executive branch the way they want. And if this governor wants a new agency to take over early childhood, my guess is he's probably going to get something close to what he wants there.
We'll keep following that. Also, a proposal from the Pritzker administration has to do with some health care changes that they want to see. Peter, you've been writing about this as well, so get us caught up to date.
Yeah, this was something that came up in the State of the State budget address in February, and a lot of people didn't see it coming. But there are what he's calling consumer protection issues dealing with health insurance policies. And they're the kinds of things that, you know, if you've ever dealt with a health insurance company that sometimes, you know, can get under your skin or cause even more serious concerns. Things like step therapy, where your insurance company says, we're going to make you try these cheaper alternative drugs first, and make you have to demonstrate that they are ineffective before we'll put you on the more expensive medication that your doctor is prescribing. That gets to be a real problem for people anytime you change coverage. You know, if you change jobs or if you move from private insurance to Medicaid, or if you retire and go into Medicare, that, you know, those sorts of things cause problems for people. And then there are other things like requiring prior authorization for certain kinds of services where your doctor has to call the insurance company and get authorization before they can give you this treatment. They want to ban that, first of all, for what's called inpatient psychiatric care. There have been some horror stories of people trying to get care in moments of crisis, like maybe they're suicidal or they're having, bipolar disorder attacks or something, and the insurance company will deny coverage, saying, you know, we don't think this is acute. We think it can be treated some other way. So the governor is going after things like this to try and impose more restrictions on the private health insurance market.
Now, Charlie, you heard some of what this will do. Your take on it as well.
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense because there's in kind of broad terms, there's sort of a disconnect between the medical community who will say, Wheeler, you need this this medicine now. And the insurance company, the bean counter, who says, well, why don't you try this cheaper thing? And if that doesn't work, then we'll consider. Or on the fact that the insurance company's website will list, here's all the providers. And then you try and go to one of those providers and you say, oh, no, I'm not associated with that insurance company anymore. The so-called ghost.
The ghost networks.
The ghost networks, yeah. And so I think, and when the governor unveiled this, he said that he figured he was going to have a lot of problems. The insurance company was going to come down, insurance lobby was going to come down hard on it. But I think it's a good idea, looking out for the ultimate patient and the doctor, rather than relying on folks whose basic job is to try and cut costs and save money wherever they can.
I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. You're listening to State Week, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler and Capital News Illinois' Peter Hancock. Charlie, I want to switch gears a bit, go back to politics, because this week, and we talked about it on last week's show, did not have a winner yet in the Cook County Democratic primary for state's attorney. They're running there to replace Kim Fox. Eileen O'Neill Burke just barely got past Clayton Harris III in that race. You've been following that from a distance, but tell us what the final numbers show.
Well, the final numbers, and this was within a couple of hours of our recording the show last Friday, they came out, and this was after like 2 weeks after the primary, and O'Neill Burke edged out Harris by roughly 1,600 votes out of more than 527,000 that were cast. And her winning percentage was 0.3%. She had 50.15 to Harris's 49.85. And she claimed victory, as I said, last Friday afternoon. And about an hour later, Harris conceded. And I had suggested that there might be a recount when we talked about it last week, but the fact that Harris conceded and congratulated O'Neill Burke means there will not be a recount, and she will be on the ballot in November.
And she'll be facing the Republican nominee there, Bob Fioretti, although most expect the Democrat to win, heavily Democratic Cook County. Peter, I'll go back to a story that you reported on this week. The Illinois Supreme Court made a decision involving a case that took a look at the state's child sex offender registry and restrictions on where somebody can live who has been convicted of a child sex offense. And there had been some thoughts that maybe the court might take another look at this and decide something different, but they were voted 6-0, according to your story, voted 6-0 to keep that law in place and upheld it as constitutional. Fill us in on this case and what led to this.
Okay, yeah, this is an issue that a lot of states have been reexamining in recent years. There was a period where states were passing laws to crack down on anybody who had anything to do with crimes against children. Restrict when they get out of prison or they finish their sentence. There were these lifetime registrations. You have to register as a child sex offender and tell local authorities where you live, and restrictions on where you could live. In Illinois, for example, you can't live within 500 feet of a daycare center, child care center. Can't live within a certain distance of a playground or a city park. And there's been some reexamination of this because it makes it extremely difficult sometimes for people convicted of certain crimes to find any place to live, or especially a place to live that is convenient for them to get a job and gainful employment. And there's not a whole lot of evidence that these laws really improve public safety. So what we had was a guy from Kane County up in, the collar counties around Chicago. He had been convicted, back in the early 2000s. He pled guilty to sexual assault against involving a 15-year-old boy. He'd was a high school sports coach. He had some kids over to his house for a sleepover prior to a competition. There was some alcohol served, and clearly some very inappropriate behavior there. And so he served his probation, and then years go by. He has not reoffended. He has completed his probation. He's done everything they've required of him. He has faithfully, you know, filled out his registration. He and his wife were looking for a new house. They found a house. They checked with the local police. All the local authorities said, you know, I am a registered sex offender. Can I live here? And everybody said, you know, as far as they could tell, sure, he could live there. They bought the house, moved in. 3 months later, knock at the door, says, nope, you have to move. You're within 500 feet of a childcare facility. And so this guy who had to represent himself, apparently there weren't a lot of lawyers who wanted to take on his case, challenged that. Of course, he did have to move out. He ended up being homeless for quite a while. And, the local court said, yeah, this is unconstitutional. But it got to the Supreme Court and they said, no, it is constitutional. And basically because the government only has to show it falls under what's called the rational basis level of scrutiny. They only have to show that there is some sort of rational connection between the restriction they're placing on your rights and some policy objective that they're trying to achieve. And they said, you know, they give a great deal of deference and said the legislature doesn't have to prove that there's any real connection. They can speculate without evidence, but in this case, they thought there was a rational connection between trying to protect children and restricting where convicted child sex offenders could live. And so they upheld the law as constitutional.
Now, apparently, Kane County, though, this will still go back to the Kane County courts, the way I understood it?
Yeah. And so there are two different ways a law can be unconstitutional. One is called facially unconstitutional on its face, which means no matter what, under any circumstances, this violates either the state or federal constitution. And then there's what's called as applied unconstitutionality, which means that a law could be constitutional on its face, but the way it was applied to a particular individual violated that individual's rights. What the court said was there was no factual evidence put into the record at the trial court level to say that this was unconstitutional as applied. And so they sent it back and said, put some facts into the record, reconsider that particular point. But overall, the law itself is going to stand.
Well, of course, baseball season's underway, some seasons always underway. There has been a lot of talk about the Chicago White Sox, Chicago Bears wanting new stadiums. And there's a lot of questions about whether or not taxpayers might be on the hook for this. Well, the former governor, Pat Quinn, has been weighing in a lot. He doesn't want to see that happen. He points to something that took place, a referendum here just recently in Kansas City when it comes to ballpark financing. And Peter, I know you're from Kansas City, so I'll let you go first on this.
Yeah, I'm one of the few people who still has the guts to wear a Kansas City Royals hat in public. The Royals were looking for taxpayer funding to build a new stadium in the downtown area. They're currently located sort of out in the Missouri suburbs or close to the suburbs in what's called the Truman Sports Complex. It went up in the 1970s. It was considered state of the art then. The stadium, there are two parts to it, Arrowhead Stadium where the Chiefs play and Kauffman Stadium where the Royals play. Kauffman or the K is still considered one of the finest and most attractive stadiums in Major League Baseball, but the new owners of the team wanted a downtown stadium, and so they wanted, this went up to a public vote, wanted the tax money, the Jackson County sales tax revenue that they get now. They wanted a new law that says to say that they could use that to build a new stadium just south of the downtown area. And it went down in defeat by a significant margin. They wanted to move to an area of town called the Crossroads. And I know that doesn't mean much to people in Illinois, but it's an area that was used to be kind of a transitional marginal area on the south side of the downtown area that has been coming back to life with art galleries and new restaurants and barbecue joints and just a lot of small business by very young and creative people who just saw what I like to call a Monty Python size boot coming down on their head in the form of a new stadium from Major League Baseball to squash them and push them out of the way to put a new stadium in that area. And the people of Jackson County said no by almost a 60 to 40% margin, which, it says a lot about, I think, the changing public and political attitude about using taxpayer money to build sports stadiums, especially in areas where you're going to displace existing businesses and residents.
Yeah, Charlie, this I don't know if this applies completely to the Bears or White Sox situation. Of course, the Bears have the what is now considered the smallest stadium in the NFL, for example, and they had talked about moving out of the city. Now they're talking about staying in the city, and a lot of people like that idea. I know some are probably concerned about what it could mean for the lakefront, but do you see some caution here going forward for both politicians and maybe for the teams?
Yeah, I see flashing red lights and warning signals and the alarms are sounding. I think it was the week before the vote in Kansas City, former Governor Pat Quinn released a survey that he had paid to have taken to get public opinion about taxpayer funding for the Bears and the White Sox. And nearly 66% of those surveyed opposed taxpayer subsidies for the stadium or for the surrounding, and this is a quote from the question, real estate developments. And half of the people said that they were strongly opposed. And so what former Governor Quinn wants to do is have an advisory referendum in Chicago and asking voters, do you support or oppose the Chicago Bears or Chicago White Sox receiving state or local taxpayer subsidies in order to build a new stadium or real estate development? Now, that would have to be, the city council would have to approve an ordinance to put that referendum on. And Quinn said after the vote in Kansas City that this is sort of a warning for the Bears and White Sox, but also the city leaders. And this is a quote from Quinn. The mayor really has to be a leader here and put this issue on the ballot. That's what openness and letting the people speak is all about.
And Charlie, I know there's a lot of people who say, well, I don't want to line the pockets of millionaire billionaires, really, these days that own these teams. And maybe there's, some of the studies that are out there say that there's not a lot of economic benefit, as much as at least has been proposed in the past, to try to get stadium financing. But there is some. I mean, keeping the Bears in the city, keeping the White Sox there would certainly have some benefits, I would think. So, I could see where politicians and government leaders are around the state and around the country are kind of caught in this. But let me get your take on it.
Well, and as I said earlier, there's all kinds of warning signs because people look at it and folks look at these team owners who are a lot wealthier than probably all of us, well, certainly than the three of us, and maybe the majority of the people who are listening to the show, they're billionaires. And so they're asking for taxpayers to subsidize what is basically a project that would earn them more money. Because part of the argument about moving the White Sox from where they are now out to a new development in an area that's undeveloped just south of the city is that they can build up a kind of an entertainment district around it, kind of what the Cubs have done up at Wrigley, by the way, without any taxpayer subsidy. And the thought is these guys are billionaires and they're just trying to line their pockets further. And so the public opposition is pretty strong. And I'm thinking, I would be willing to guess that if the Chicago City Council does put a referendum, an advisory referendum on the ballot, the Chicago voters will say very strongly, not a single penny to those folks. And the irony, and we were talking about this before the show, Kansas City Chiefs have won, what, three of the last five Super Bowls? Mm-hmm. The Bears last won a Super Bowl, I want to say, in 1985. And the White Sox, as we tape this show, the White Sox are actually behind the Kansas City Royals in the American League Central standings.
And you're a White Sox fan, so that took guts to say that. But
I know.
Peter, just about 30 seconds here, but you're at the Capitol. I'm guessing you're nothing public, at least. You're not hearing a lot of discussion about some type of last-minute package at this point to help one of these teams or both these teams?
Oh, you always hear rumors that something is in the works, but I think Governor Pritzker has made it pretty clear that he is not a fan of using taxpayer money for private businesses such as major league sports teams. And so you would have to really convince the governor of the need to do this before it would get past his desk. And I don't see that happening.
All right. Well, let's go to our notes from the field. Peter, we'll stay with you for your note.
This was a week, a deadline week for the legislature in the House. It was the deadline for House bills to make it out of committee, even though they may come back to those committees for further amendments. And so there were a lot of things that went through that we almost don't have time to cover or talk about. But there were a number of higher education bills, the potential for student teachers to earn stipends while they're student teaching.
All right. And Charlie.
Well, this is the first week in April. And so we have from the University of Illinois Flash Index for March, and it rose marginally to 102.8 from 102.6 in February. And that continues sort of a year-long modest growth trend. And U of I professor J. Fred Geertz, who compiles the index for the University Institute of Government and Public Affairs, said, "The United States and Illinois appear to be in the soft landing pattern, the goal after the strong post-recession expansion. With the rise of inflation relaxing, attention has turned to if and when the Federal Reserve will loosen monetary restraints." And the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, the legislature's fiscal guru, reported that so far in this fiscal year, overall receipts are now up a net of $714 million over the receipts at this point in FY23. The income tax growth is kind of leading the way. It's been up a net of almost $1 billion through March.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.